Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. You're going to need a bigger closet with Fright Rags' biggest sale of the year. Huge savings on tons of tees, pins, socks, and more now through Wednesday, November 28th. Hurry, sales are while supplies last and shirts are literally flying off the shelves. Save an extra 10% with coupon code SHOCK10, 10% off through December 31st. Severin Films Black Glove Friday Sale, November 23rd to 25th, featuring the two-disc Blu-ray Special Edition premiere of Sergio Martino's classic giallo, All the Colors of the Dark, starring Edvig Fennec with soundtrack CD. Also available in a strictly limited slipcase with the three-disc All the Colors of Giallo, new feature-length documentary, Hours of Giallo, and creamy trailers, and a new compilation CD of giallo themes, selected by Rendezvous from the archives of Beat Records in Rome. Also premiering limited slip for the Severin Black Friday sale, Ivan Nagy's Skinner, starring Ted Raimi and Tracy Lords. Scanned in 4K from the original negative, uncut, uncensored, and packed with extras for the first time on disc anywhere. And finally, get real strange with the first in the Severin Films Something Weird video line of Blu-rays, two Mondo double features, Mondo Bizarro and Mondo Freudo, and Eco and The Forbidden. The Severin Films Black Friday sale with 50% discount on most catalog titles and new merchandise and exclusive on All the Colors of the Dark, All the Colors of Giallo, Skinner, Mondo Bizarro, Mondo Freudo, Eco, and The Forbidden. Do not miss the Severin Films Black Friday sale at www.severin-films.com. Tonight's Shockwaves is brought to you by Shudder. AMC Network Shudder is a premium streaming video service serving fans of all degrees with the best selection of horror and thrillers. Shudder's irrepressible and thriving community revels in all things provocative, evocative, and dangerous. From bantering with Shudder on social media and contributing fantastic and irreverent reviews to relishing in member-only perks such as exclusive releases and VIP movie screenings, Shudder believes there is safety in numbers. You can stream great thrillers, horror, and suspense for $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year. Shudder has the largest, fastest-growing human-curated selection of thrilling and dangerous entertainment, and they've been dubbed the Netflix for horror. And I'd say right now there are some excellent originals on there. Terrified has been Shockwaves approved. The Witch in the Window and the series Dead Wax are all fantastic. To try Shudder free for 30 days, go to shudder.com/podcast, and that's Shudder, S-H-U-D-D-E-R. And use the promo code WAVES. Welcome to Shockwaves Live from Knoxville Central Cinema. Now, this is particularly exciting because we have finally achieved the most purest, finest form of Shockwaves by eliminating the other three hosts. And it is just, this is the essence of the show I've been dreaming of for a very long time. But of course, just to rub it in my face, Rob G happened to steal the show in the last documentary, saying all the smart things, and he's haunting me even here.
Wow.
So, and Ryan Turek's out there having the number one movie in the country. And Rebecca's wrapping her film yesterday. So, actually, that maybe makes me the loser of the four, which is very interesting. But
you crushed it like Quint.
I crushed it like Quint. You're right. I don't know about the rest of you, but my legs are starting to fail after 3 days of like nonstop cinema. This has been pretty intense. But this is a wonderful cinema that we're in, and this has been a really terrific festival. So this is a cool honor to be able to wrap this thing with some pretty cool people. What I wanted to do was to actually have the all three are filmmakers, but they're also judges. So I thought it'd be cool before the awards later for you guys to get to know a little bit more about the people judging something. They're not all judging every section, so they can kind of explain what they're doing. And we're going to do something that, has anyone heard, I do another show called Pure Cinema. It's a movie general show. Appreciate that. I mean, even though Brian's probably listening. You can cheer for him. What we did on the first episode of that is something I really liked. And I called it handshake movies. And it was just, it was something that literally just sprung that in my mind. But this idea, not what are your favorite movies or what are the best horror movies, but what are the five movies that basically kind of define you if you had to shake someone's hand and go, yeah, these are the five. I don't know why. These are the movies that made me who I am, a filmmaker, a fan, whatever it is. And so I always think these things are fun mental exercises, but in this case, I also think it's a great way to get to know somebody. And these guys are all really interesting people, so I thought this would be a cool way. So that's going to be part of what we're doing today. First, I will introduce these people who you've probably seen in various capacities throughout the last couple of days. I'm going to take a good crack at this. To my left is Jill Gavargazian. Is that right?
Gavargazian.
Okay, sorry.
So close.
I know, I'm getting better. By the end of this trip, we're only staying in the same house. So. Who's both a filmmaker, had 42 counts here, had the stylist probably 2 years ago, I'd bet.
Yep.
Yeah, which is brilliant as well. And also is judging the features.
Yes, and the grind out.
And the grind out. Okay, so welcome, Jill.
Hello.
And then to her left is the best I've ever had. I mean, really is. The teeth come out and everything. Brian Lolanano, who is, too soon, the director of Gwilym, which is Crowhand, which is the film I first kind of met and bonded over. It's such a wild piece of filmmaking. And the brilliant BFF Girls, which Jill also is a producer on, that premiered yesterday.
Woo! Woo!
Welcome.
Woo! Thank you. Thank you.
And then... podcaster, critic, every all around, 1 minute filmmaker as well here today.
1 minute, folks.
Don't eat it, Dave, because you'll be sick. JK, so welcome.
How you doing? Thank you.
So before we just jump in, you know, you have to have a little bullshitting up top about what you've been watching, but we've all been seeing some pretty interesting films. We just finished Survival of the Film Freaks, which was, you know, the most perfect documentary for this crowd and for us and for the topic on the show. It's a film that taps into not just nostalgia. What I appreciated about it was looking forward. It was, you know, most of these things are just nostalgia pieces. Like, this is why we love these movies, but they're trying to figure out where it's headed. I was just curious from watching that, did you guys see, was there any clip not present that you were like, oh, you know what my cult movie is? And not to grill those bad guys. I know this is painful for them, but was there that thing that in your heart you're like, oh, you know what I would really want to see on that? It would be XYZ cult movie or something that kind of, or something in it that kind of got you excited.
This isn't a movie, I think. Well, maybe it should be, but a moment in it, you guys mentioned, they mentioned that, you know, when you were younger, you were just looking at poster art and that, or the cover art, and that's how you would pick the film. We didn't read the back at all. And some, there was that one you would avoid like your whole life. And I avoided Monkey Shines because of that cover with the tambourine toy. Because I had that toy as a kid and I was terrified of it. So I assume it's like a Chucky-ish type film with killing people my whole childhood. I finally watched it only a few years ago. I'm like, what the hell is this movie? It's like a sci-fi horror that Monkey has nothing to do with it. Like it. Love it.
That's a good question in its own, like VHS covers that scarred you, too scared to watch, but we'll get there.
Yeah, I totally agree. Monkey Shines was a horrifying poster. I thought Child's Play was a pretty horrifying poster too. But a poster that always kind of intrigued me, but I never wound up seeing the film, was Deep Star 6, because like it was such a cool like image of that person with the diving bell helmet, and I was like, how could this be a horror movie? It's about a diver, you know. But what could possibly go wrong? I guess like one film I was hoping to see in the highlights, because it wasn't released until it got a limited theatrical release and then a Blu-ray release, was House.
Which was super obscure until recently. Like, when that went Criterion, it became huge. Yep. But up until then, I think that film was really under the radar.
Yeah, and I was lucky. I had an experience seeing that completely blind in 2009 at the Boston Underground Film Festival. And I was just totally blown away. Like, right from the get-go, it was just bananas. And I just, like, loved, like, I didn't know you could make a film that just, like, throws everything out of the... every rule out, you know, and you're like, yeah, you can have that kind of transition for this one shot where nothing like nothing majorly important is happening, but like it's still like a great flourish. Like, it's just like so kinetic. I love that film.
I can't see the influence of on that at all on you.
Right.
Like, especially your new film, not at all.
Yeah, I only say
It does. It's super fun. And Jay, what about you?
976 Evil.
Oh, yes.
Always love 976 Evil. You sit there and, you know, some of the... I worked in the Blockbuster video, so it was firsthand that I would go by the cover boxes every single night. And on the particular one we had, it had the scene with the hearts in the hands. And it's such a great scene. It's a film that I looked at, and kind of like to what Jill alluded to, it kind of freaked me out a little bit going by, especially when the lights were off when we were cleaning up, and it's like those eyes were following you. So 976 Evil for me.
Not the sequel.
Not the sequel, no.
Not as good. Yeah, for me, I had to throw on, well, I was very excited when somebody mentioned Fright Night 2, as you probably heard.
Yes.
I let out a little pee, which was very exciting for me, because I've been sitting in there so long. But I'm a big fan of, and this is somebody I got to know when I first got to LA somehow, but Slumber Party Massacre 2 is so much fun. Like, the surreal moments of it, like the big zit. I mean, if you haven't seen that, I feel like it's way up your alley stylistically in some ways. Yeah. But the woman who made it, because that's an interesting series, because it was all directed by a woman.
Right.
And that's, you know, Corman, again, always kind of a little ahead of the curve. But her name was Deborah Brock, and she was largely in the editing room. And just meeting her, she hasn't made many other things, but she's really funny and strange. And she is the first person who taught me, because she was in the editing room, the term which I hadn't heard before, which was frame fucking. She was just like, we're in there, you know, we're frame fucking with the producer. And I was like, frame fucking? She's like, yeah, it's when you're fighting over every little second with the producer. I'm like, that is my favorite term in Hollywood. So God bless Deborah Brock, who's really cool. One other thing I wanted to ask you guys, because I'm always curious about this stuff, is, like, do you remember, like, first horror memory, like, first thing? Even if it's not that clear, and it could end up leading into some of these films, you know, because how they influence you, but do you remember that first thing that you're affected by, that very first, whether it's a film image or whether it's something on TV when you weren't meant to be seeing it? I'm curious.
I'm not sure what I saw first, but I remember, like, growing up, I always liked to play any game that was scary, like, you know, any version of anything at night, or for no reason going exploring the woods. That's like what I wanted to do because it scared me, or go in the sewer.
Yeah. Cemeteries? Did you go to cemetery?
I tried to. There wasn't close enough to my house. but I just love that feeling. I first gravitated towards crying in films, so then it went to fear. I still love to cry. Yep.
Okay. let's see. So, Child's Play again, because when I was 5, we were watching this live Peter Pan special on television, and like right before the news came on, they decided to play a commercial for Child's Play after this family show, and I was like, what is this? I was horrified.
You actually hear that a lot, that a lot of people's early, and this term kinder trauma, is from the commercial spots. I think the biggest one was Charlie Band talking about the amount of hate mail he got over Ghoulies ad campaigns, because parents would say, my kid can't even sit on the toilet now because of what they saw. And if they'd seen the movie, they would be cured of their fears, because the Ghoulies aren't even on the toilet in the movie.
It's
nowhere near as good as the campaign. But I think that's really interesting that it didn't even take watching a whole movie.
Yeah.
It's just commercial.
Yeah, exactly. Or sometimes like the artwork, like Jill mentioned, The Monkey Shines. And I went to a video store trying to rent Short Circuit Two in a Goofy cartoon, like on tape, back when they used to have like 4 on a tape, and like there's a giant Child's Play poster right by the popcorn machine, so I'm like averting my eyes the whole time trying to rent the Goofy cartoons and stuff.
When you finally saw Child's Play, did it,
I was like,
it was still scared, like, or did it help get over it?
Yeah, it helped me get over it, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah,
but like there was, like, for a long time I didn't watch The Exorcist because my mother saw it when she was young, and she was like, she like was scared shitless, like she had to sleep in the same bed with her sister and do rosaries every night. And we're Catholic, so they were terrified. And then I saw it, and I was like, yeah, this is horrifying. Like, it's pretty horrifying. It's still pretty scary. That's my.
How many of you grew up with neighborhoods where you had friends over behind your mom and dad's back? Raise your hands. Exactly. My first one, the first memory that I have that I can remember, is watching Faces of Death with them.
Oh, Jesus. Wow.
Faces of Death. And I went ahead, and it's never left me. It really changed the way I saw the world at such a young age.
Yeah.
As you can see from my shirt with Audition, you know, the pain and all that stuff is part of life. But for me, the image of the monkey's brains never left me. And it just settled with me, and that's my first horror memory that I have.
How old were you?
had to be
like fucking hardcore.
9, 10.
Okay. Jesus.
Well, it wasn't my choice to bring it over.
I won't even watch the rest that shit right now.
Well, I just, you know, it's just the way it worked out. Friends come over, they bring movies behind parents' back, and that's what happens.
Did you guys, we had, there was an episode, it never aired, and that could happen to this. What happens with the live shows, you never know if the recording quality will end up being good enough, but we did, me and Becca recently did a show called Bold Horror Statements down in, that's not a diss on anyone, technically.
You, horrible
I have no idea how this is going.
You did Horrible Imaginings.
Horrible Imaginings.
Yes, I was there.
Oh, you were there. Yes. That's right, you were. But no one's ever going to hear that episode. We're doing Bold Horror Statements. And
it was great.
One of the ones that I was, I have so many friends, obviously, everyone I know is in horror in some way pretty much in L.A., and they all show their kids all these horror movies and then talk them through it, and it's all very hands-on, like parenting. It's like, now we're going to watch this, and I'm going to talk you through it. And they're trying to make horror fans, right? And I, so my Bold Horror Statement that day was like, you guys are probably going to find this could go the opposite way, because no one let me do shit. Like, this was all behind people's backs, late at night, at friends' houses, and that made it exciting, and that made it feel like it's kind of, that's the punk connection, I think, to doing things behind your parents' back. So my fear is that a lot of my friends who think they're going to create these cool horror fans might actually just make people find it very very routine. They might like them when they're little and then go,
desensitized,
whatever. Exactly, or be bored. So my question was actually just out of curiosity, what kind of households did you guys grow up in, places where this was an acceptable behavior, or were you actually told not to watch certain things? Were there any restrictions? Because I think restrictions actually really help push us to want to break those taboos, you know?
Yeah, my parents didn't probably start letting me watch them around 13, 14, but I started at 10 at my friend's house, uh-huh, where the parents did not pay attention. I had to stay with her for the weekend.
Yeah.
But yeah, I always tell parents now, I'm like, you shouldn't let them. It's fun. Like, that's part of the fun. Like you're saying, to sneak it, and you're not supposed to be watching it, and it's scarier.
Well, and I mean, I think the documentary we were just watching was all about discovery. And if you take some of that out, because somebody's doing the work for you, I think they were mentioning lists, but in this case, parents or, you know, tutelage in horror sounds to me like, come on, I want to find this. But yeah,
they were horror wasn't a big thing in my house. I think the first R-rated film that I saw at home, with like my mother like chagrining, you know, being like, no, but was Predator.
Oh, yeah.
Nice. I was like, yeah, this is really bloody. I was like surprised, like, wow, I didn't know movies could be like this. As far as like that kind of rebellion, it wasn't with horror, I'm sorry to say. It was with one movie and one TV show. My mother couldn't stand The Simpsons. Oh. And then she wouldn't let me watch The Simpsons, Married with Children, Fox, basically.
Yeah.
I could take and leave Married with Children and Living Color, but I defied her and I watched The Simpsons. Like, I got in trouble, like they turned off the television and stuff. I always had to watch The Simpsons. And then the movie was Batman Returns. She fucking hated the Penguin. She was like,
oh, really?
So disgusting. Yeah, like she was like, this is not for kids, it's gross, blah, blah.
And interesting that you
were
thinking
of like
William.
Burgess Meredith. Yeah.
William and the Penguin, right. There might be a through line here.
There, yes.
This is like my psychoanalysis show where I just invite guests up and slowly get to the core of things. All right.
but yeah, it was those two things. But you know, once I got past that, she was like, yeah, whatever. So you can watch whatever.
But never watched with you. Did any of you have?
No.
Okay.
No.
In fact, I'll tell you, I came from a divorced household, so things were always strained. I had two sisters, and my one sister was way more popular than me, so she would have her friends over, and it was all a matter of not being oblivious, I would think, based on everything going there. And we would watch Evil Dead. We'd watch Friday the 13th. I'm from Blairstown, so I'm right there where it's filmed, so there's already that aura, and you're in the neighborhood with kids that are just having a good time. They're experiencing things. So, you know, the household was a haven for kids to come and hang out, you know, as it was in supposed to be in the 70s and 80s. So
I just have to add a slight footnote, because I don't want to completely throw my mother under the bus.
Uh-oh.
She did show me Monty Python and the Holy Grail, which was my first exposure to violence being used in a comical way, like the Black Knight and the Rabbit, like all that stuff. That really blew my brain.
Yeah, I think for some reason, I think, no, I don't want to say broken families, that's a little heavy, but like children of divorce, there's this, it's an easier in. Like, I've talked about a lot on our show, I guess, but I had a stepfather who was a Presbyterian minister.
Oh, wow.
But because they're trying to impress you, or like, you know, trying to be on your side, your friend, when I brought home like all the Friday the 13th films, he just sat there during the day watching them with me. And clearly, in any other scenario, he would not have been cool with it. But with me, he just sat there and he was like, oh, oh. And he kept saying, you know, should you be watching this? And I'd go, yeah, I think so. And he kept watching them. And it was kind of amazing when I look back on it, because it's like, what a weird time where people, I feel part of it was the time where people weren't really fully aware of what, and I still don't, I don't believe media creates violence, but I think people are talk about it a lot more post that. This probably pre-Satanic Panic, maybe, or right around then.
Speaking of Satanic Panic, my mom, at some point when I was younger, she was like, horror doesn't bother me, only the devil ones. Mm. And that was like, at whatever age she said that, just like drilled an obsession with the devil to this day. So I'm like, cool, now make a list of all the devil movies I need to see immediately.
Well, I guess that actually opens up another idea. Was there something that you guys, like as horror fans, I feel like we all have something that we actually, especially early, maybe do avoid because it maybe freaks us out a little more than the other things. Some of the things you're watching and you're gaining confidence and you're getting control of your nightmares or fears, whatever, because I always say we're the biggest scaredy cats of all tend to be the horror kids, you know? But was there anything like that you avoided? For me, it was, what was that? Is that label Fascination, like Jean Roland? And all those movies, the covers of them felt like naughty. Like there was something about like, oh, I shouldn't touch that. I shouldn't go near it. And it took me not until like 20 till I probably saw any of those, that label. Anything like that?
Yeah, I actually grew up with some weird aversion to science fiction and sci-fi horror. I think it scared me on a weird level. Like even my dad watching Planet of the Apes, something just the way they looked freaked me out, like probably 2-3 years old. Star Trek freaked me out. There's so many things I didn't see until I was older because of that.
You're scared of ideas.
The new the
future.
Frontier.
You're scared of the future.
Yeah. More scared of things that are way more unrealistic to me.
That's interesting, though.
I think because I was Catholic, I stayed away from a lot of the devil ones. Uh-huh. Those were kind of scary.
Do you remember seeing Exorcist first time?
Yeah, but I was like in my 20s.
Uh-huh. And not with your mom. Saw it.
And not with my mom. Okay. No. And another one I watched with my mom was RoboCop 2, but she was like, it's a little too much.
Nuke.
She was a good sport. And we wound up watching a lot of like classic horror movies later together, which was really nice.
It for me, and it wasn't up until about the last 7 years when I started doing Horror Happens Radio that I really got ingrained with it. But after watching those films, once everyone grew up, I kind of went away from horror. Mm-hmm. I got into comic books, X-Men, Marvel comics, a lot of that. And it wasn't until Eli Roth put out Hostel and that Achilles cutting scene. Mm. And for the longest time, I could not get over the fact of going back to it. And as soon as I saw that, it just opened the door right back up for me. So it was a while in between.
Yeah, I mean, that's also kind of interesting. What drew you into horror or maintained your interest in it as adults? So not as kids, I think it's pretty straightforward. Those of us who get into it, it's usually we saw something we shouldn't, or we are trying to get over certain fears. But like as an adult, I had a similar experience, you know, in my 20s, kind of losing interest. Also, some of the horror films of the 90s just were not grabbing me at a certain point. And then, you know, for me it was like House of the Devil and The Descent were the two films I saw kind of back to back, where I was like, fuck yes, this is what I've been waiting for. The 70s styled horror films were back, but I had gone into art house and kind of movies like that, styles like that. But what keeps you interested? Like, you know, obviously you're making films that are comedy, horror, all sorts of subgenres, but what do you think it is that keeps you interested now with horror as an adult?
I've just always loved films or really anything that is just really confrontational. So I think the same with sad and scary things. They're both things that make you feel something extreme. It's not just like passing entertainment. Mm-hmm. That's what I love about it.
So you want to leave a mark.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, I'm with her on that. But also, like, I'm a huge fan of the horror from the 30s and 40s. So atmosphere is a big deal for me, and I really love those films for their atmosphere. And they always were taking place in. They were always well dressed, and they had cars, but they also had horses.
They
never know when
cat people.
It was set, you know. But I really love those films. Those were great films.
A lot of that's in the what you don't see,
right? Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you want to say something, Joe? Okay. You know, looking at it for me, and for those who know me, it's finding out about the stories of the filmmakers, talking about the projects, understanding why they're doing it, because horror is such a big black mark for so many people. Getting behind the scenes and finding out how it ticks, why they're doing it, going ahead and discovering is the thing that fuels me. It really, really reconnected with me to be able to become a fan again. So,
and you guys also, you know, are on festival circuits incessantly, so probably some of these films you see multiple times. Are you still getting, as filmmakers, fueled by other people's work when you're seeing some of these shorts? I know even just today, seeing Blood Spook, there's like, I know Steve's left, but just seeing moments of that, it's going for something, and sometimes it's bigger than just being a short form 6-minute film. It's kind of bursting at the seams with ideas, and that still gets me excited and wanting to do this stuff. But do you guys still find discoveries like that?
Yeah. Absolutely. Definitely. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go. No, it's okay. Go ahead.
Festivals just kind of fill you with inspiration, and it's around being around other filmmakers, also just other people that are kind of like in that place with you and know also the scary parts of it. Mm-hmm. It's like inspiring, and I don't know. I love it.
Yeah, absolutely. There was definitely like there's three that I saw this weekend that I was like, wow, those were great, like for different reasons. Like the one you mentioned, Blood Spook, like it had such great, I was so like aware of what that world was and all the weird characters that inhabited it, like the guy at the gas station who had the crazy like you know, teeth, and the clerks at the convenience store. I loved it. Was so random and bizarre, but I like bought into it, you know.
Did you guys pick, did he say in the Q&A that Warren Oates' son was in there?
No.
There's a guy you see wearing an ascot. Warren Oates, the same ascot from Tulane Blacktop, and he's in one shot of that film. He lives locally, and they asked him, and I was like, that is so cool. It's Warren Oates' son. But you see that, like, there's just these people, you know, pulling in real people, just littering it with something that feels authentic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it had such atmosphere. Yeah. You know, it was something that I gravitate towards. And there was a couple of shorts that, like, I love when a short is, like, challenging, like Jill mentioned, because it's so bizarre. Like, I've seen very, like, sexually uncomfortable films, and I guess that it was like, oh, I should do one, you know?
you succeeded.
There was a film I saw 4 years ago, I would say. We were at a festival in Florida, my wife and I, and we were there for the midnight shorts, and we had this sort of, like, zombie short about a funeral home where the dead come back to life, but the funeral home director has to kill them so that way the funeral can continue, they got to keep their business. I saw this other bizarre, amazing midnight movie about a guy who like cuts his, he's like a rapper, a white rapper with cornrows, and he cuts his head off and he has sex with it, and then there's like this cartoon that plays, and it doesn't make any sense at all, but I was like, wow, somebody can make that. Yeah. And look at what it's playing like at festivals everywhere. And then it was like that day actually I looked down on the ground and I noticed this thing that looked like a crow totem, and I was like, oh, we should, you know, I should pick this up. It looks cool. And my wife said, no, don't pick it up.
That's good.
And I said, oh, what's going to happen? So I joked that my hand became a crow, and I yelled out crow hand. And we said, oh, we should do that. And it was because we saw that movie, which is called What Up. If you guys should look it up, it's fucking bananas. It was the next day, I think, we decided, like, we should really do crow hand. Because if that guy can make a film, we can do crow hand. And so...
Well, and also festivals are where you're seeing people push the edges, because in the cinema, it's unlikely. You might get one thing a year that pushes envelopes. I think Hereditary is pushing some real general audience envelopes, you know, and you're lucky to get that, you know. But when you come to places like this, it reminds you, like, if horror stops being punk and if horror becomes too much the mainstream, I, for one, will probably lose a lot of interest in it, because if that just becomes the flavor everyone's drinking, it loses something. So it's great to see works, even ones I don't like. I really love seeing a film where I don't quite like it, but I'm like, but fuck, I'm glad you just went for it and you pushed the envelope.
So much of what they were talking about in the film, you know, how things don't have to be clean or polished, or like they're talking about video stores and stuff like that. Like, I wanted Crow Hand to have the same sort of like energy and spirit that something, you know, you would find on like adamfilms.com, which is something I gravitated towards when I was like younger, trying to get into film and realizing like you can watch this stuff on the internet. And back when IFC stood for the Independent Film Channel, and then play Predator five times a day, which I love the Predator, but come on. And yeah, I mean, yeah, like they played blocks of short films too, and I was like, oh wow, like you can make a film and it doesn't have to be a feature, it could be a short. So,
and I think that's where I want to make sure we give a shout out before I forget to William Mahaffey and programmers in general, because I think you know, there's one film particularly I saw here where I was like, you know, 3 minutes in, I was like, I would have definitely turned it off. Like 100% if I was sent 100 screeners. And then by the end of the film, it's definitely a movie that I am like blown away to have seen at this festival, because it's so batshit. But sometimes you get blinded when you see a lot of movies by the quality, in quote marks. And that could be as simple as, oh, it looks like a shot on Shitio, and it's kind of, okay, the acting's kind of amateur, all right, I'm done. And your brain can just turn off like that. But if you have the wherewithal to see it through, you might discover something truly, you know, special. And so I think programmers, you know, it's not always the most glamorous gig. They have to wade through a lot of submissions. We're in a time where movies are very easy to get made. Doesn't make they're never easy to make, but easier to get more movies made. So, shout out to William Mahaffey, who is right here. So, plus he loves attention. He loves being clapped at. He loves. What about you, Jay?
You know, for me, I go to a lot of festivals. I love festivals. This is, I think, my 18th festival this year going. And I go for a couple reasons. One, I love the audience reaction. I love being a part of that atmosphere. I love seeing what the films do. I also love digging deeper. There are some films I've seen 6, 7, 8 times. The Endless. Last year it played here, I believe, right? Mm-hmm. Tigers Are Not Afraid. There's a whole slew of them. I watch over, I'm looking to see if there's something each time, and was a film like that for me this weekend, where it's the third time I've seen it, and this is the first time it actually broke through with me, and I actually enjoyed it. And part of it was the audience, part of it was the aspect that it was a different appreciation. Plus, I wasn't half asleep, I'll be honest with that, about that. But it's those kind of elements that drive me to want to come to the festivals and discover just like everyone else.
Yeah, the audience reaction, and like you said, with something like Luz, some films hold like a mystery, and then the second time you see them, they open up.
Right.
Sometimes it's the audience who open it up for you.
Exactly.
Like,
right.
We walked out of one, and everyone's bitching it out, and then I walk around the corner, and people are saying it's the best thing they saw. So that's also a really special thing about festivals. Okay, so let's get into some of these movies and see where that might lead us. Because I'm, you know, genuinely curious. Somebody backstage was taking our pics to put up some images behind us, and he said that not a lot of overlap, which shocked me, because as I was doing mine, I felt it's pretty generic, because these are not my, you know, in my opinion, the two best horror films ever made are not on my list, which feels weird to even start talking about horror movies when I clearly think they are the best two films, but they don't have as much of a personal meaning towards for me. So let's kick around and see what kind of things we come up with. So you want to start, Jill?
Sure.
No pressure.
I'm going to start with Candyman.
Yes. Great movie.
Oh, yeah. It deserves a round of applause.
It does.
Well, it's one of the very first that I remember seeing, period.
In a theater?
No. Oh, okay. Like, that was when I would go stay with my best friend Courtney for the weekend, and her parents just let us rent anything.
Yeah.
So I saw that at like probably 10 years old, and still to that day, to today, I think that movie's absolutely terrifying. So,
and romantic.
Yeah, it's
and haunting. It's like so many
layers.
It's also,
yeah, tragic and very much like the classic monster films.
Yeah.
I think that kind of cemented the idea of me really liking the tragic villains, where you're scared to death of them and feeling a little sad for them.
Like attraction, repulsion of the villain.
Yeah. And just like him standing in that parking garage saying Helen, like, he's so iconic to me that every time I've seen him at a convention, I'm like, it's Candyman. Like, he is Candyman. I just love Candyman, and I kind of feel like everyone loves it, but for some reason, it just also feels a little underrated to me.
Yeah,
like, it should be thought of as big as, I don't know, Texas Chainsaw to me.
Yeah, I mean, and I agree, and I think it's also the best horror, well, I mean, Scream's up there too, but I think, you know, best horror film of the 90s, definitely the most classic in that sense.
Yeah.
I think part of that might be just the fact that there hasn't been a really nice release till soon. It's
about
to happen finally.
Just announced, is it Scream?
I think, yeah,
Factory?
Right? Arrow, Scream, you can
a
all
Blu-ray?
Cheer.
Blu-ray?
Without Rob on, I have no one to look at for Blu-ray nerd news.
And it has so much, you know, it's political and socially relevant, yeah. like still.
Probably and more so maybe now, you know, it'd be interesting.
It's just a very smart film, and I think it, as a kid I saw the title and you think Candyman, it sounds like a silly slasher movie.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, not silly at all. I just freaking love Candyman. Yeah. And I'm scared.
No, I think it's brilliant.
I got to take a picture with him standing behind me through a mirror.
Oh, nice.
Dream come true.
I judged a costume contest with him once. I was at a convention and we were ahead to judge like a cosplay costume contest. It was me and the Candyman and one other guy.
He is the Candyman.
Yeah.
I've seen him in any movie. I'm like, it's Candyman.
Was it Hellfest?
No. He's in Hellfest. Oh, man. Somebody help me out because my memory's so bad. Who listens to the show? I was just talking about this movie. It has Michael Rooker as a priest. And
Shadow
Builder. Oh, my God. This was not a great movie, but Tony Todd has the wackiest cameo I've ever seen. He's like wacky neighbor guy who keeps coming out, and you're like, what is going on? It's very strange. Anyway, you don't have to watch that one.
I guess I'll go. I'll be real quick because I mentioned this one earlier. I'll say House. That film, like I said, it blew my mind in the theater, and it was such a riot to watch. There it is. Like, that is, like, that's amazing right there. Like, her head cropped off with all of these painted heads, and it doesn't care that that's not realistic. And that's so much of, like, what draws me to the kinds of films that I make or the style that I try to exude is, like, I like a theatrical, I like a fake look, you know, I guess it would be called theatrical, and it's thanks to Hao Su that I've been able to discover lots of other Japanese films that are in genre that are very stylized and very theatrical, like Tokyo Drifter by Suzuki.
Suzuki, yeah.
And I also watched all but the last female prisoner
scorpion.
Yeah. The second one has this amazing sequence when they're in the woods and there's this like old witch woman or something. There's just this amazing stuff. And like these are things that they were doing that I was like, I tried to do like in some of my earlier films. Like I love Black Voids because like it's better for like you know, lack of production design. But if you put your character against black, it's with some nice lighting, and like it adds to
it. Horror films, like one of the reasons I think a lot of people are drawn to horror is there's still aesthetics. There's still stuff happening.
Yeah.
And what I think's happened in movies, unfortunately, a lot of times I think people think that realism means handheld camera and everything looks the way our eyes see. But I also teach, and I always tell my students, it's like, but guys, that's like only a tiny portion of our day. A big portion, we're asleep having dreams that are unfiltered. A lot of times you're seeing things through reflections and mirrors. Sometimes our brains are going back in time thinking about our past, and they're dreaming of what we want to do in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So to limit yourself to optical reality is a total snooze fest.
Yeah.
But the only genre that gets that is horror films. It's the only one that has continually pushed dream sequences and just ideas and blurring these things. And that's exciting. And I think your unreality sometimes feels more real than someone who makes something that docu-style, which sometimes isn't really grounding something, you know? So emotional authenticity is one thing, but visual can be a different. And so I think I think it shows in your work. It's cool.
Thank you so much.
Sorry to get nerdy.
For me, The Ninth Gate. I love Polanski. Was that a groan or a cheer? I'm not sure. Okay, let's turn off that for a second there.
I'm glad you brought that one.
The Ninth Gate is wonderful. It's, for me, Johnny Depp's best character is Dean Corso. I love him. And Franco Langella as Balkan. I mean, he's so over the top, so over dramatic. You're dealing with something also that you don't see in a lot of films, and that's something that's tangible. He's going after books, and that's something that you really don't see. And I loved it for worked in Walden Books. I have books all around me all the time. And to see that, and I've always been a fan of Polanski. Love The Tenant. Love what he does with the paranoia, and I love with this film how it looks and, you know, the European feel. And, you know, again, Johnny Depp is such a sleazeball in it, but it's so relevant to a lot of what we see when it comes to filmmaking and the industry and stuff like that. You deal with that kind of stuff. So it, on a lot of levels, it works for me.
Yeah, that's a really interesting pick. For me, I mean, I feel like that's the bummer for me being part of the show is if you listen, most of mine are already probably been done a million times. But the first film I ever saw was Creepshow, but that just fucked me up. That didn't, and I'm not counting that as making me, but the film that is definitely left the biggest impact on my entire life was seeing The Shining at 8 on TV. The next day I had choir practice or something because this new stepfather of mine who's making us go to church. And I watched it. It had commercial breaks. And I've never never before or since had as close an experience of what cinema is, the power of a medium. Forget the horror parts. It's just being drawn down hallways, being pulled along. Like somebody reached out and grabbed me around the head and said, watch this. And it hasn't lost that power at all. It's one of the few movies that still I could watch it anytime it's on TV. I'll just sit down and start kind of gazing into it. That's why I think it's such an interest. I think he obviously just put so many layers into that movie. But I've told this before, but it might seem really silly, but like when the mirror shot happened that said Red Rum, it was the most exciting moment of my entire life. My brain had never had, like, I was like, I wonder what Red Rum is, you know? And then the mirror, and it's like, murder! And, like, now it sounds ridiculous because we're, you know, as adults, we always see things before, you often see them before the twists come. But as a young person seeing that movie, that was like I just was in the hands of a master, and that's what stories were. And from then on, I was just utterly hooked. I think that movie just, like, profoundly altered the course of everything for me. And I remember the next day going to that choir and telling all my friends how amazing it was, and they were just they'd seen it too, and they go, it sucked. Literally, that was what I got. Everyone just went, no, it sucked. And I was like, what? So we were just in different, you know, places with that one.
I wish he did more horror, because like that's a genuinely scary movie. Yeah. And like the reasons I get scared of it is because like his snap zooms, which I love, like they're unpredictable. You don't know if it's gonna snap zoom in or not. So like sometimes there'll be this really, really wide shot. And they won't do it. Like when Danny first sees the twins, and it snap zooms on him, but it doesn't snap zoom on them. And it's just very horrifying, like these two people just staring at you. And then later in the doorway to the bedroom with the bear and with the dog, sorry, and the guy like getting blown by the dog guy.
Yeah.
And
clearly inspired.
Yes. There's going to be a lot of I'm going to say something and everybody's going to be like, well, obviously, because you did Quillian. Yeah.
But it's also, I guess, it's sex and death. Like, probably a lot of the early things we watch were as young people trying to figure out what sexuality is. And for me, definitely the most profound scene of any movie is Jack going in, you know, with the woman, the beautiful woman initially in the bathtub, because you're just, even if you don't know what it is, you're just drawn to it. And when she changes, you know, and it took all these years later to realize, oh, that's marriage. They're talking about, I get it now. Yeah. But at the time, it was just sexy. That was meant to be a joke. And everyone's like, oh shit, that's depressing. Sorry. But you know, it is interesting the different lens you see these things over years. But that film hasn't aged to me. It's kind of like Candyman. It has that kind of perfect quality.
Music really adds, there all the music by like Bartok and Penderecki. Yeah. Like Penderecki is like the perfect composer for horror films. Like, because everything he does is horrifying sounding. And like Philip Glass composing a horror movie.
Oh,
like,
God, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like
the Candyman score is amazing.
Right. Yeah. Well, his music. I like his music. I know a lot of people are like, fuck Philip Glass.
Did he do Seven also?
No, that was Howard Shore.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Ask me about that, and I know all about film scores.
Next
Pure
show,
film
next
score
show,
podcast.
Next
episode. Yeah.
What's a second for you?
Scream.
Uh-huh.
I was like about 12 when it came out, so it was, I mean, made for like, you know, that age. And I had already been watching horror films for a couple years, but I think that's kind of what taught me about becoming a full-on nerd about it. That's like the beginning of the internet days, and I remember finding maybe just like a fan website, or I don't think we even said blog back then, but they had pointed out all the references to classic horror films within Scream, and I basically used that list as like, this is how I'm going to train myself to become like legit horror fan nerd. Yeah. So I just like use that as like, check them off. So yeah, it really just taught me about so many other horror films. Yeah. And I love the film still to this day.
And the opening sequence as its own film.
Oh yeah, it's amazing.
In recent horror, that was just the pinnacle, I think.
It's
left
and
field.
For the, you know, all the teen horror that came after, that one is still really gory, and it's more adult than the rest that came after. Yeah. But actually what's amazing is that Kevin Williamson, he just realized, like, you know, fucking realized what he could do and blew the fuck up. That guy is still creating, like, he created like Vampire Diaries, like his whole like teen horror he figured out.
But that's one thing, and this was brought up in Survival of the Film Freaks, that you know, certain directors and certain projects match. And I don't think Scream would have ever been what it was if Craven had not gotten the hold of it and be able to go ahead and bring that humor, that self-reflection to it. It's really amazing what he was able to do with it.
Yeah, making fun of himself, the line, like...
Yeah.
What does he say? It's a something Craven. He mixes two names to get... Tatum says, like, you sound like a something Craven flick. I'm so sad. I don't remember this line.
Were there other directors?
That would have been Ryan Turek. I would have had that one quickly.
I'm sure there were, because he went back and forth with that for quite a while, according to what they say. So, and then jumped on. So Craven's such an interesting director.
It's called Scary Movie. Yeah.
Yes.
He'll come up again. So we will talk about it. Every decade he reinvented the genre.
Yes.
Yeah, and no one else can say that.
His career going from starting with those super sleazy. Yeah.
Extreme.
You know? Extreme films in the 70s. He's done it all.
He really has.
Well,
my choice is also a slasher movie. Some might say the first slasher movie, Psycho. I know it's a tried and true, and everybody knows about Psycho, but Psycho means...
The Hitchcock version, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, no.
The remake.
Get that down.
I do like me some Walkman references, but...
You like the cow shots in the van.
Yes, of course I do. Yeah, the
Clouds
faux
cows,
Nine Inch Nails music video in the middle of the movie.
Yeah.
I saw Psycho when I was in high school, and it was the first black and white movie that really drew me in. You know, for a while, everybody was like, "Michael Wyatt's boring," but this was amazing. Like right from the get go with the titles, the shower scene. Of course, actually, I always think of the shower scene if I have to cut a scene that requires something to happen very quickly. You know, I referenced it. I used it as a reference in both Crowhand and Gwilym and BFF Girls. Like, I always think of the shower scene and how that scene is constructed, and when I'm editing, I'm always using that as a reference. And subverting expectations is also an amazing thing. Just like Scream, you think Drew Barrymore is going to be like in the movie and she's killed off. Instead of 30 minutes, it's 8 minutes or something.
Yeah.
And then you're sort of like, oh, well, I guess we're going to carry on with these people now. So,
well, and also you think how crazy it is to not just kill your main character, but then be forced into the point of view of for quite a large portion of the actual killer.
Yeah.
Which is super uncomfortable and unheard of at that point. Like this is before we had a Henry Portrait of a Serial or something like that, where you're really forced.
Yeah. It was very new to follow to have that happen, and then to follow someone else, and it just totally it threw a wrench into the narrative, you know, which I thought was great. And another reason I think about that movie a lot is I think of it with my own work, because Hitchcock did North by Northwest beforehand, and then he wanted to do something completely different, you know, and it was going to either blow up in his face or it was going to be amazing. So I think of that a lot. I always think of those kinds of films after somebody has some kind of a success. Not that I'm rolling in the Benjamins with all that Gwilym money, but
could happen. Well, I mean, it was an independent film kind. I mean, it ended up being with the studio, but he put everything he had at personal risk.
Yeah.
And I think when people often when people go all in like that, it's worked out. I mean, my favorite story, I mean, it's not really hard, but was Cassavetes' wife, Jenna Rollins, was asked. She said, "We mortgaged our house 6 times for films," and then she just takes a pause and she goes, "I still live in my house."
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's pretty beautiful.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's like they took all this risk, but we're still here.
Luckily, we didn't have to mortgage anything, but...
Yet.
But, yeah. Not on a short. Oh, my God. That'd be awful. But, yeah. And of course, the relationship that Hitchcock had with his wife, not to get sappy, but I do think of the relationship I had with my wife, Tori. Have it with my wife, Tori, on our films, especially Crowhand and Gwilym. You know, we're a solid team.
And would
on
you
that.
Say your relationship with the BFF girls is like him and Tippi Hedren or not? All right, next question.
I'm going to say no.
Okay.
You know, for me, when you said about handshake films and introducing it to the people out there, again, this goes back to why I love film festivals, because every year you discover crowds and you discover festivals that really leave marks on you, and Train to Busan left a mark on me. Train to Busan was one of those films that every time I talk to someone, it is by far the greatest experience I've ever had in a theater. And I've had some good ones before, but nothing like this. And what this film did was so different than most of the subgenre of the undead. You're already in you're in a train and you're not going anywhere. And instead of sitting there playing victims, you fight back. And Don Lee, who is the big ass bastard that's in the back of those three right there, when he walks into that car and he's got the other two and that music, those drums hit, you're just psyched out of your skull that he's going to go in there. He's going to beat the shit out of every single zombie that's in there. It's also a film where you care about the characters. And that's a big thing with me with films that stick with me. That you care about them. And you'll see that later on with another one that really influenced me, as well as A Handshake. But it's definitely with Train to Busan, it's a film that I look at and I say, this is a undead film that did it right. And this is coming from an animator. You know, when you look at this, get it up here for a second, Sang-ho Yun, I believe is his name, he came from animation. So when you look at those undead, they're creative. They're animated. And it is really an incredible film just to go and watch with a group of people. And that's a film that I would say without a doubt is something that would not only welcome people into there, but by the time it's over, some people, there's 250-pound guys next to me are crying their eyes out, you know, at the end of that film. So it's means a lot.
Yeah, I think that's what people don't know if they just see a trailer, is just how emotional that film is.
Oh, very much.
And that's really like where you're talking about emotion and how you can fit that into a film with a hordes of zombies running around. It's really beautifully made. Hands up if you've seen that one. All right. Anyone who hasn't, I think that's a great recommendation.
Yeah.
So Wes Craven, you know, the next film that made a real impact, and I still think about it all the time, is A Nightmare on Elm Street. It's so brilliant, the idea that if you go to bed, you're still fucked. Like, that's so great, because, like, it's bad enough to be scared when you're awake that he takes over that dream space. And the way it opens, and I think, like, one of my, you know, I get some heat from this because obviously Part 3 is so popular. It's kind of like our generation's favorite in a lot of ways, but not for me, even though I love it and it's fun. The first one, if there had been no other movies, I can't even imagine. I feel like Freddy would still be considered easily the scariest thing ever created by mankind if there'd never been a sequel and there'd never been commercials and fun things. Because he is a terrifying child predator in that movie who's burnt and has clothes and his arms, the scene where his arms reach out.
He's got personality.
Yeah. He's got personality. And yet, the thing that's actually, when I think about this movie, the image that really got me, I think I was 10 when I saw it, or 10 or 11 when I saw it, was the body bag is actually, so not even Freddy. The horror scenes I remember are how we remember things that scare us slightly off. And so like a body bag standing on its own in a hallway at a high school, it just was utterly terrifying, and that a young person dead is terrifying, right? And that film just really stuck with me. I had the misfortune of going to a sleepover, like kind of place where you were going, Jill, and they didn't tell me that they had just watched it before I got there. They said they were all going to fuck with me, and I was already scared about seeing this movie because I'd heard how scary it was. It had just come out on VHS, I guess, there. And, you know, I'm sitting there, and as soon as I think when he comes out and there's a big stinger, you know, somebody jumped on me, and I literally almost died. I mean, that's as close to a movie killing me as I think I've become. But then afterwards, I like couldn't stop thinking about him, because even in that, even though he's mostly scary, there's still something charming there about him, and you want to know more. Like you know, Michael Myers and Jason are fairly devoid of personality. They have characteristics, but not personality. Whereas Freddy is personality, yeah. And then when you hear Wes talk about how he was created, you realize us as horror film makers and creators have to take in the world around us. You know, him taking a person who menaced him.
The reality
taking
so scary.
Kid, you're taking some adult who passed you and wanted to scare you, wanted to scare a little boy, stayed with him, you know, and then putting that in, and I think that's why it works so well. And then what Robert Englund was able to do. But that's a film that just never ages. You know, there's certain scenes that don't hold up as well as others, but as a whole, it's a real horror film. Like, it's creepy.
A lot of the practicals, you mentioned the arms extending, that is really creepy with like the fog in the atmosphere, and it's so unnatural, and like people could laugh at it looking fake, but the scene with him sort of like pressing against the wall as if it's like rubber, like, and then I saw the shitty remake that they did, and it was all CG. I was like, this is bullshit.
The little Freddy, baby Freddy, I call him.
Yeah.
Shorter than everyone else in the movie. Yeah, I mean, I think this is another argument I often have with people about It Follows, which is this idea that people get mad, a lot of people I've met get mad when rules or logic somehow aren't followed in the horror film. So I had friends coming out of It Follows going, but they broke their own rules, they broke their own logic. I'm like, the only rules ever spelled out in that movie were by some teenager who was trying to figure out what the hell happened. So that isn't scary, having rules. The whole point of horror is like messing with them, and I think that first Nightmare, he can do anything. You have no idea what he's capable or not capable of, and you have to try to figure it out with the... It's not really till three that they really master how to fight this guy.
Yeah. And that's reflective of Wes Craven's style. I mean, yeah. The Hills Have Eyes, everything. I mean, you just never knew what he was going to do. It was so unpredictable.
Dangerous,
and he came
yeah.
from a Disney, watching Disney films in the Catholic background. So it's...
Him and Paul Schrader both came right. from strict Calvinist upbringings. So the guy who, for those who don't know, the guy who wrote Taxi Driver, you know, wasn't allowed to watch movies till he was almost 20. And Wes Craven didn't watch a movie till he was in college because of that. Really, and so you imagine, and the first movie he watched was Night of the Living Dead. Can you even imagine having not grown up on movies and then sitting down and seeing Night of the Living Dead, what that would do to your brain? I have no idea.
Yeah, and he wasn't, his goal wasn't to do horror. He kind of fell into it and then just kept going. It's just crazy to think that you became like such an iconic director and just didn't even plan on doing that at all.
Yeah. It's funny. People ask, what's my favorite Wes Craven film? I say Music of My Heart. For those, that was the one that he was able to get done.
His
that
Oscar
was,
shot.
Yeah, he loved it. He loved it.
Meryl Streep, yeah.
Yeah.
She got nominated for an Oscar for that.
Yeah.
One more note about Nightmare on Elm Street. The ending... The dreamy looking ending, I would definitely paid homage to that look in BFF Girls in the park scene because it has this haze all over it, especially when the girls are drawn to the tampon cart.
You are so amazing, tampon dude. Cart. I love you. I love you.
That's good.
My next one is When a Stranger Calls, the original. You guys probably remember this. We watched the Scary Stories doc here, and there was a story in the, I don't know which one of the three, called The Babysitter. Yeah. And it's, you know, the same legend as When a Stranger Calls. But it's the more tamed down version. The kids aren't found all butchered in the Scary Stories version. But that one always stuck out to me as a kid, that story, because I think it was most realistic, like someone being upstairs and calling. That's when everyone had the second line. You know, that was all the rage, to have two lines at home or your own line as a teenager.
Oh my God.
Did you ever have to babysit?
Yeah.
I can imagine an older sister
with two little brothers. So that story always really stuck in my head. And when I found out there was a movie with the same title, I remember specifically having my mom drive me to multiple video stores to find that one. And I think I ended up finding it in, grocery stores back in the day would have their own little section in the front, and it wasn't at Blockbuster or any of the major ones. And yes, still to this day, I just love the idea of someone calling from upstairs. And I think that has cemented my love for, or I was more scared by human monsters, like killers, serial killers.
Home invasion.
Yeah.
I wanted to actually mention, watching 42 Counts again for the second time, I really appreciated that you never see the guy's face. You only see him from behind. So I really and even when he's walking towards, he has this lumber. So he's like a monster. Yeah, it was great. It was a nice touch, Jill.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
He can be anybody, right, at that point.
Exactly.
Yeah. I wanted to make it clear that it wasn't his story. And when he did that walk, that shot, we were like, holy shit, you're terrifying.
Yeah.
Mm. Like, he needs to play like a Michael type character after that walk. Like, he's huge.
Well, if you listen to Shockwaves, and if you don't, you should check out Rebecca and Rob both brought up part two of When a Stranger Calls, talking about how the first 20 minutes of it plays out like its own little movie. And so I finally did go back, a couple months back, and it's, if you haven't seen it, it's brilliant.
I don't know if I have seen the second one.
It's literally brilliant, the first 20 minutes.
I think I have, because it's the same. It's the babysitter as an adult with her kids. Yeah.
No, it's Jill Schoelen from Popcorn and Stepfather and everything. She's come over to babysit, and then she's getting knocks at the door. And it's just this perfect 20-minute sequence that sucks you in. And the rest of the movie's pretty fun, too. And she comes back.
I'm thinking of just the final scene of part one.
Okay, yeah. But if you haven't, check it out, because that's one of the best recs I've ever gotten from them. It's super cool.
My next pick is a sequel.
Okay.
It is, as much as I love the first one, I love Bride of Frankenstein even more. I think that's a great film, and it's so quirky, and I love the story, that they got James Whale back to do it, but he wanted to do it his way, and it was very it was just very for lack of a better word, flamboyant. Because obviously James Whale was an openly gay director, but that doesn't necessarily show in the film. It just shows that it's a very quirky, unusual movie. I can't remember any other, like, unless somebody knows of any, like, films from that decade that are that unusual and quirky, with quirky characters and stuff like that, especially that woman who kind of looks, she's always, like, screaming her head off and stuff. Yeah. And Dr. Pretorius is an amazing character. I love that there's a character named Dr. Pretorius in From Beyond. Not as great as the Dr. Pretorius, but he does have a great line, "Touch me if it pleases you." Also, like, making the monster sympathetic, you know, without, you know, I'll just go ahead and say it. The scene with the monster with the blind man is, I get misty-eyed watching that scene.
Oh, yeah.
It's very touching, and it's my, it plays a favorite classical piece of mine, which is Ave Maria by Schubert, and it's just, like, so tender and so, like, sincere, and I don't know, it's just wonderful. I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it. And of course, she was amazing at the end. How she moved, it was so unusual, and like I said, I hadn't seen anything like that before. So I say Bride of Frankenstein is my favorite film from that sort of, like, 15-year decade of wonderful universal horror films, as well as the Val Lewton films. Mm-hmm. You know, this one is the grand marshal of that parade.
That scene with the blind man, like, I think it really, like, solidifies how, you know, just that he's misunderstood, because the one person that can't see him, that's not scared, that doesn't judge him. Yeah.
And
that whole movie's a tragedy, and the ending of her not understanding him.
Oh, yeah.
Social politics,
too. She hates me,
because, like, the idea back then that a woman would then be married off to a man, and that's what you do in your life, and the idea that just because they're dead, that's still not enough for her.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's still just, like, repulsed and scared of him, and it's like, that seems really just kind of original.
There's also the undertone of Pretorius stealing Frankenstein away from the woman he's supposed to marry so they can create, you know, there's a very, like, homoerotic undertone. To that side story, but wonderful.
And watch Gods
movie.
Of Monsters afterwards.
That's a great,
because that's a great film about the director, James Whale.
Exactly. Bride of Frankenstein.
Cool.
Well, for me, part of getting back into horror was the aspect of Bravo's 100 Scariest Movie Moments back 2002 or 2004, and looking at it, listening to Eli Roth talk about Audition. Audition is one of those films that never leaves you. And the great thing about the film is, beyond the fact of how beautiful it is, the style of it, the aspect that Miike adopts Murakami's work so well, is the idea that, you know, it's a dark drama leading up to that 20 minutes. And it's really for some people. And then Ithaca Fantastic had a screening a few years ago as part of the Body Horror retrospective through Shudder. People going into it, the hype surrounding the film is terrifying for people. And people have the hardest time sitting back and building towards that. Some people are fine with it. Some people are not. And to see those scenes where you have the kitty, 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 and you see what she's able to do, what the character of Asami is able to do, and the aspect of throwing up into a bowl, it's disgusting. And it's exactly. when it comes to it, but it's all built up because of how Miike builds that story and the damage that she's had throughout her life. And it's also a very sympathetic story, because there's moments in there you feel for the lead, I guess, protagonist, antagonist, depends on the perspective of what you're looking at with the lead male character, and with her as well, because she's a damaged character. But in the end, it just goes batshit crazy. And I absolutely love the fact of what Audition does. And that's a film, if people are saying, well, what's something that pushes me? That's something I recommend, because you really have to work your way through, and you have to have the patience to get to that gooey little center that is Asami at the end of it. And it's really a masterstroke for me.
Yeah, I think it's one of the best horrors post 2000, and it's also one that I think is extremely topical now, because if you people forget the story that he's a Hollywood producer,
right,
and he's using casting books to cast his new wife.
Yes.
So this is just, like, right in the throes of what we're going through and the shift of this culture, and how we have to actually protect people from this kind of exploitation, which is, I think it would be ripe for an American remake, even though I'm not, you know, that right. excited about that idea. I do think now would be interesting in the right hands. Not Eli Roth for that.
But the way Eli Roth, though, and that's the thing with him, he sat there and he's already over dramatic. We know mm-hmm. that. But he sat there and he goes, when the scene when she's sitting there in the bag just starts to move, he goes, she's crazy. And just looking at how he reacted inside, I went, I've got to see that. I want to see that. That's got to be something as I move back into what I used to love. That's one of them I have to see.
Yeah. Okay, so for me, the next one that did it and the one that most pushed me to wanting to make my own films was, because it was the first time I could tell a movie was handmade, is Sam Raimi's The Evil Dead, which I actually always thought Evil Dead 2 was so much better. This last like 15 years of my life, I was like, yeah, Evil Dead 2 is so much better. And then about a few years ago, Beyond Fest played Evil Dead 1 and 2, and Sam Raimi and Bruce were there in between. And when I saw those two things on the big screen, Evil Dead kicks all the ass in the world.
It's a great
I mean,
film.
Seriously. I couldn't even believe how much ass it kicked. It's just so handmade, and everything is a problem that they've solved, and they're 21 fucking years old while they're doing it. And I, even though Evil Dead 2 is this amazing movie, I found myself so much more drawn now back to this one that first got me into movies. And it's scary. You know, the stuff with the trees, you know, it's just awful, and it's grotesque, and it's horrifying. But the movie just has the spirit of people who went out and did it, and they found a way to make this movie. They put cameras. I mean, that's the first movie that I then had to find a book to find out how things were done. And I got that book. I think somebody, what is it, Regional Horror? It's got Evil Dead on the cover. People probably know what it is. It has like Shockwaves is in there. There's a bunch of movies, Wiederhorn interviews. And they talk about putting a camera on a spade or a 2x4.
Right, a piece of wind just dragging
slowly
it.
Taking it through the forest. But when you watch that, you forget all that. You're not watching the craft. But I did know as a young person, like I could tell somebody had gotten together and done this somehow and wasn't a studio product. And man, that was exciting and refreshing, and that's probably 16 or 15 or something, and it just made me go, yeah, well, if you can do that, then why aren't we doing it? And we started making a lot of like SVHS movies right then, like, you know, the next day if we could get our hands on a shitty camera, and it was so much fun. And you know, just you know, I more than anyone, I want Sam Raimi to make another horror film. There's no one more than Sam Raimi I want back in the fall.
He's so great with camera work. I love his camera work, and like, I didn't see For the Love of the Game, but like, for like most of his other films, you know, even like Spider-Man and Spider-Man too, like there is that Sam Raimi touch that's in there. And so when he came back with Drag Me to Hell, that was great.
Yeah. And if you haven't seen A Simple Plan, you're looking for a perfect little movie.
So
it is like a perfect thriller. Seriously. Yeah. Like, and it's not showy and it's not Raimi-ish in the way we think of it, but it's still just great filmmaking. Anyway, The Evil Dead.
My next one is Idle Hands.
Rodman Flender, shout out. He listens, so he's one of our good listeners. So.
Awesome. I have dubbed it recently as the ultimate stoner, satanic stoner horror comedy. It's just so weird and unique. It's, I think, hilarious. I actually just hosted a screening of it in Kansas City a few weeks ago. And it kind of was at the start of a lot of people's career that blew up, like Jessica Alba, Seth Green, even like Vivica A. Fox is playing the ridiculous, like, she's like hunting down this like big conspiracy behind the whole thing.
And The Offspring.
Yes, Offspring, isn't it, singing The Ramones? I don't know. But also Devin Sawa, who anyone attracted to men my age grew up, you know, he was the heartthrob of the time. Casper, Now and Then, Final Destination is also a favorite of mine. I just love everything about that movie. It's so ridiculous. And the gore is so much fun. The hand is actually, I learned, played by the same hand actor from the Addams Family. So that's a thing, apparently.
Wow. That is actually good to know.
But yeah, it's just so silly, such a unique idea. I love that movie. And there's this crazy alternate ending that involved this like pool scene with all this fire and madness. I find it crazy they didn't use it.
Oh yeah, I don't know about that.
But yeah, it just has turned me into a lifelong Sawa fan. Sorry, the Sawa's family.
He's on Twitter. You can talk to him.
We're going to get him to share this. I'm sure.
Yeah.
I was going to list one, but I'm going to hold off and make that the last one I do, because I'm going to jump on the coattails of Elric and talk about Army of Darkness, which my favorite.
So fun. Yeah.
That is so telling of the kind of films that I want to make. case in point, when Bruce Campbell falls into the bloody pit and it's really quiet, and then that witch pops up, the way she pops up, and the first thing she does is just starts punching him repeatedly in the face.
Yeah, yeah. That's true.
Like,
yeah.
When I saw that, I was like, that's not normal for a medieval movie.
Yeah.
But, like, I loved it, and it was just so silly, and I realized, like, later on how big of an influence the Three Stooges was on him, obviously, like, with all the friggin' skeleton hands coming at him in the graveyard, but, like, the how silly it is, but also, like, how exciting the camera work is and the editing, like... That was a big influence on me on the kinds of films that I want to make. So yeah, I'm a big Sam Raimi fan and Army of Darkness. And it's like he has these fake skeletons just hobbling about, you know. And it's just like, I just love it. It's just completely fun and doesn't take itself seriously, which is something I always, you know, just aim to do as a filmmaker, is just have fun and like not take myself seriously, but I take filmmaking seriously. So
yeah. That makes total sense. I had never thought about that film with you, but now perfect.
I love Death Proof. All right, it is for a lot of people with Tarantino. It's you know, this is one of their least favorites. I love how he is able to construct soundtracks. And I'll tell you something. When I go to Fantastic Fest, driving down the streets of Austin, all I think about is frickin' Death Proof. And to have Kurt Russell, and I, you know, the people that they talked about, the cast for Stuntman Mike, they talked DMX, they talked all kinds of really weird people, really outside the box. But you just, there's no one else that could play Stuntman Mike. And Kurt Russell is so cool. And then just on the simple fact that you have some of the most amazing action car chases, the inspiration they drew from, and all the kick-ass fucking women in the film. Unbelievable what they're able to do and how this film here really tried to bring back grindsploitation. They tried to do that. They weren't very successful. But this is a film that has such great homages, such a great soundtrack. It looks good. It's fun to watch. And it's got some of the coolest dialogue. So I love it. This is a film that I go ahead, if someone's looking for that hybrid, this is that hybrid for me.
I agree. I feel that it pays more homage to the grindhouse types of films than Planetary does, because there are such large gaps of, like, mm-hmm. nothing happening. It's so true to the types of films that he was paying homage to. But yeah, it's like, it's a perfect example of, like,
when Kurt Russell's in the car and looking at Rose McGowan sitting across, and he turns on the dime, it's so terrifying that a Disney actor who's got that beautiful smile can do something like that. It's some of the most scary. And we saw it this weekend with Clovis Killer. You know how, you know, you get a actor who is not traditionally cast like that, and you put him in that role and let him have fun with it, and he just knocks it out of the park. So Death Proof for me. And if you haven't heard the soundtrack, fucking get it right now.
And he turns on the dime after he gets shot in the arm. He becomes this crying person. Just like, so good. Of course, like, what do you think?
He's so overdramatic.
Yeah.
He's so good.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's a great role. The next one for me is, I saw it when I was, I think, my first year of college, and this friend of mine said, you got to watch this movie. And I watched it, and I was like, that really doesn't work for me at all. That movie was called Suspiria. Like, the first viewing, I was like, what? Like, why? But it's why is that light there? She's just in a taxi. Narratively, this is confused. That's where I was at 19, I guess. Now it's become one of my favorite movies of all time. It really was a weird experience that first time. And the reason, you know, if this was a longer list, I'd have a lot of Italian horror, especially things like The Beyond by Fulci. But really, it all started with Suspiria opening the door to this, because even though I didn't fully get it, there was enough images that made me go, okay, I got to watch it again. And I saw a better copy of it that helped. But it opened up wanting to see more of those films, seeing Opera and Inferno and other movies where you really realize this guy is working in a dream logic way, and it's so personal to him. Like, killing someone is so personal. He needs to fetishize it. He needs to have his own hands doing the killing. He needs to push it once. It's not enough to, like, have killed the woman, and, you know, now we have to stab the close-up of the heart being stabbed. And you're like, okay, this is the work of, I don't want to say sick mind, because I think this is all, you're working through stuff, but there's something going on. And I could feel the direct behind the film in that, and man, have I grown to love it. I think the first 20 minutes of that film is as good as anything ever created.
Exactly.
It's so intense. The use of music is so radical. You know, camera work, color, it's just fascinating.
What was the tagline?
The first 19, the anything scarier than the first 19 minutes is the last.
Your heart
next 89.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like basically the whole movie.
Yeah, it's like the whole thing's good. That's what I'm telling you. And also those creepy hairy hands and hairy arms at the start that come out. It's just like, oh. Yeah,
the ending is wild.
Yeah.
The ending is wild. And when I saw it and I said, and the credits started scrolling, you have been watching.
Yeah.
I want to do that more. Like,
and that's why I wasn't at all concerned when I heard about the remake, because you could remake a movie with the title Suspiria about a dance academy, but it would be literally impossible to remake that particular movie. There's not many movies like that, but that's one that's like, yeah, good luck. If you want to make that color palette, do you know how hard it was for them to achieve that color palette? The way they had to shoot using mirrors because lights mm-hmm. were too hot to directly aim at the actors? I mean, read up about the way that's made it so unique and challenging, and it pays off on screen. So I'm excited that this will be something different, and it doesn't matter.
I saw a Fantastic Fest,
okay, cool.
And I'll tell you something. It's a reimagining of everything that you love and more. It's going to be something that's going to surprise a lot of people.
Cool.
And I really enjoyed it, and I'll tell you something. It's made by a fan of the film also, so yeah. Keep that in mind.
And it's cool that they kept it in Italy. I was impressed by
without
that. Italian director,
yeah.
That's cool. So.
My final one is an obvious Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original, of course.
The best horror film of all time, in my opinion.
Yes.
In terms of just the most powerful horror film. But
It's obviously the best and scariest horror movie of all time. But what's weird is I don't remember the first time I saw it, but it's been my favorite movie as long as I can remember. And I think a lot of it is that I also, like I said, loved to like explore the woods. I like to road trip. I like to be in the middle of nowhere. I like to almost put myself in the like middle of nowhere horror movie subgenre all the time. And that's the first movie that really I saw like that. And I love, like Candyman, I think Leatherface is a somewhat sympathetic character, and damned to be what he is. He's not like blood hungry. He's just doing what he's told to feed his family. And you get to see the interactions between the families, the scariest thing to me.
Yeah.
It's just always stood out to me. It's just something so, you know, raw about it while it also being so artistic.
And that gallows humor, you know, like,
yeah.
Because it is, when they're all around the dinner table, it's kind of funny, but it's also a complete, utter nightmare.
Yeah.
Like, it's the worst thing you can imagine, just opening your eyes and suddenly these people screaming and laughing at you. It's terrifying, yeah.
And recently someone pointed out to me, it never dawned on me, but that compared to slashers, we're normally used to, the victims figure out that they're being chased at some point earlier in the film and are kind of, it's more of a chase scenario. And with Texas Chainsaw, every single victim walks up to the house having no idea. Versus Sally's the only one that already knows what's happening. And I think that makes it very different in that way. It's just, you know, and it's that psyche behind the serial kill, behind Leatherface, is kind of the most repeated, like, psycho. You know, they're all based on Ed Gein, and I'm insanely inspired by that. Like, the stylist was my Leatherface. That's mostly what she was inspired by. And yeah, I just love that, as disturbing as this is, that I feel sad for Leatherface. He's just yelled at and abused and doing what he's told.
And it knows how to end a movie. I mean, that's the thing about a lot of horror films and short films that you see here. Like, some movies just know when to cut. And some movies go another 3-4 minutes. And both features and shorts always... And you know, as an audience, you know when they had you. And that movie is nightmarish.
Where it chooses to end. That's a shorter one. Might be like 75 or something.
Oh, yeah, maybe. But it's just perfect. Like, he's left swinging in the air.
Yeah.
And
yeah. No, that's... it's funny. Like, so many of the ones that are brought up, like Suspiria and Death Proof and Texas Chainsaw, they all have these wonderful endings.
Yeah.
Like, you can't beat, like, a kicking montage of Kurt Russell at the end.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that the house exploding at
she's
the end
just
of Suspiria.
Smiling with this mysterious smile about things.
Yeah, and then, you know, Leatherface, like, flailing around and stuff like that.
And Sally's moment, like, laughing. Someone, I can't take credit for this thought either, but that someone pointed out to me that Toby did that a lot in his films, where he'd show just a glimpse of the trauma that person, that they may have escaped the situation, mm-hmm. but, like, the start of what they're about to go through, a whole nother horror. I like that a lot too. I always think about what happened literally after that.
Yeah, and if anyone, Fangoria's back, as a lot of you probably know, it's really great. It's so cool to see the high quality. But the best thing about the new one, besides they chart the history of slashers from Myers, which is really good, but there's this awesome part where they're looking at sequels that were proposed back in the day, well before Texas Chainsaw 2 was made. And one of them is really about Sally, like, going back and, like, becoming part of the group and stuff, and it's crazy.
Oh, wow.
Some of the stuff's really... Whereas I kept thinking, like, imagine if the sequel was actually just Rolling Thunder, and the guy comes back from Vietnam, finds out Sally was his daughter, and she's been taken. He's like, fuck this. I'm going to, like, make my weird hand hook and go after them. And, like, that movie would be so badass. Anyway, tangent. Next.
My final choice is also a Tobey Hooper movie, or is it? It's Poltergeist.
Oh, well.
It is.
Don't do this to me.
No. I'm not going to. I'm not going to at all.
Can I set the world straight that
respect.
Tobey Hooper did direct that movie, because
yes.
That's what it says.
Yes.
But we did have a guest on our show once, and I got a lot of heat from certain people in the industry for asking a question. Because all I said was, hey, by the way, who directed it? Like, jokingly, not thinking he would tell us a very controversial answer, and then a lot of Tobey fans got mad at me personally, and I was like, what the fuck? I just asked a question. I think it shows both the hands anyway, you know?
It does, yeah, absolutely.
But it was always a Spielberg project. It was always produced by him.
Yeah, it's written by him and produced by him. The movie is incredible, and it touches on all these things that, like... I don't know. It's like, it's very hard to describe, like, all the reasons why I love this film, because it uses every effect that Industrial Light and Magic had at their disposal at the time to beautiful effect. You know, the cloud tank stuff of the clouds, you know, overlooming like that I've seen in Close Encounters in the Dark Crystal. You have that giant monster in the doorway, you know, with the large arms and stuff, and that's a puppet done in a tank of water. It looks incredible, and they did a similar effect in Raiders of the Lost Ark with the ghosts flying around the Ark at the end. The score by Jerry Goldsmith is incredible. The scene alone with, is her name Tangina? Zelda, yeah. Rubinstein? And her whole monologue about the other side, and then she's like, now hold on to yourself, there's a terrible presence in there. And they don't even describe this thing as a person. It was a ghost. She calls it the Beast. I mean, that is, like, it's chilling. And the performances by Craig T. Nelson and Joe Beth Williams are so believable. Like, it's like, you don't know if the family's going to survive, because, like, if you didn't watch Coach or The Incredibles or something like that, yeah. You know, Craig T. Nelson's not really, like, on your radar.
Wow.
But... you know, and yeah, there's like a lot of like early Spielberg things that are very familiar, like a dysfunctional sort of family that's always screaming at each other. But the gore is really, you know, intense, you know, when the observer is like pulling his face off. I forget the guy's name. What is his name? Mark won't be coming back. It's Mark.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I am coming back, and I'm bringing some help.
I think that was the scene with the face peel where I felt most like, oh, that has to be Tobey. But that actual scene, everyone says that was a Spielberg moment. Weird.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird? Because it's so grisly.
It's not
I
weird.
I thought it would have been...
Because he's a sadistic director.
Right,
he
yeah.
is like... There are moments in his films where I'm like, this is sadistic. You know, and you know, like, I watched that Spielberg documentary, and he would always tease his sisters and torment them and stuff like that. So I totally buy that, you know, that he could be real sadistic in his films.
Well, that film, I mean, I think the power... Because that's of any film that scared me in the 80s, that's definitely the one that did the most. But, like, I think it did what Stephen King did. It's the bringing horror to suburbs and your safe spot, which is your house, and your, like, suburban lifestyle, which shouldn't be a problem. That's your... we were watching some documentary yesterday about the home. It might have been the Scary Stories one, where they're talking about the home's the one place, and all your stuff's there, and you feel safe. Well, what if all your stuff is what's tormenting you?
Yeah.
What if your clown is the thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, the clown scene is, like, just absolutely terrifying. And, and the tree, you know, that takes Robbie. Even the whispering scene with the doctor and Joe Beth, you know, talking at night. Yeah, there's just so many wonderful moments. And also, like, the blocking, too. Like, the blocking scene after Tangina says, let's go get your daughter. That's all done in one take, and they're just moving the camera around to different positions of the room. Like, it's just, it's great. It's definitely, like, my favorite horror film, you know.
And your favorite collaboration.
And my favorite collaboration. Yes.
Safe.
You know, for me, who was here for Don't Eat... Don't Eat It, Dave's. Who was here just before that last block? There's like three of you. if you don't know, Night of the Living Dead is like a huge impact on me. Night of the Living Dead is the only film I've ever wanted more than anything else. And going back, you know, everyone here at one point in their lives had school clothes bought for them. I told my aunt right to her face in the middle of the store that I wanted this VHS copy of Night of the Living Dead over school clothes. She couldn't believe that I would do that to her. And she's not religious or anything, but she's it's just the shock of it. This film for me is just incredible. It's celebrating its 50th year. The practical effects with it, the fact that it's just so innately scary, the fact that, you know, I could be looking at you right now, and then 10 seconds later, you could be the undead, which is a shell of what you are. And what Romero was able to do, what Russ Steiger was able to do, what John Russo was able to do, was make it so claustrophobic and so scary, and to have, "They're coming to get you, Barbara, they're coming," just those little touches on it that went ahead and just made you sit back and go, "Is there something coming out of the closet? Mm-hmm. Is there something underneath the bed?" It, for me, it scared me. And this is a film that, if you're looking for that bridge film, a handshake film, this is the one to go to. Because, yes, it's 50 years old. Yes, the effects are not up to par, but it's still so effective. And it's so scary. And what Romero's impact was can't be denied. And for me, the score, just sitting there, the aspect of what Judith O'Day goes through as the victim, the trauma that she goes through, and then how it's reinvented in the remake of Night of the Living Dead. It's a film that has influenced so many people, so many projects. It's unbelievable.
One of the best things, if you guys aren't watching the AMC series that just started with Eli Roth hosting The History of Horror, even though I was angry that he didn't bring up Fulci, that was just a pet peeve. But there were some really interesting things, and the one thing I thought that was really interesting were they saying it wasn't that there was an African-American lead that was right. Shocking. It was that he was in charge. And they were and people were watching this movie where he's the one telling this like middle-aged corporate
that's
white
right.
guy, "You listen to me, man, and go downstairs." And it's like, that's powerful, 1968.
Yeah.
And so, yes, the ending obviously is what we remember. But actually, when you think about just the balls and whether Romero's telling the truth, as they say, or not, that he just cast the best actor for the role.
He says that, he
you know,
that
which,
a lot.
And I think even if that wasn't true, I actually really appreciate that that's how he puts it. Because yeah. I think that's quite a powerful thing to put out there. That you're not just looking at the surface of this.
Right.
You're just...
Well, he's all about revolution. I mean, the story is that literally they threw the film can in the trunk of the car when Martin Luther King Jr. was shot and he was assassinated. So it was amazing timing. And I will say one thing. On a personal note, one of his last appearances at the CT Horror Fest up in Connecticut, I was his handler for the day. The guy is a robot. 9 hours sitting there, meeting every fan, signing every autograph, talking to every single person. And at the time, he's very ill. And he only peed once. The guy is just a robot. And he really is undead. But he's just an impact of the person he was. Also, just emphasizes how great it is.
And like a lot of these directors we're talking about, they didn't think they would end up being stuck
right.
in horror. But what they did is once they realized that, he's like, then I'm going to make the most of it.
Right.
And I'm going to use horror like what it's best used as, which is a Trojan horse for ideas.
Yeah.
Just like Get Out was last year. This is an idea-driven medium. And then you're able to wrap it in these amazing packages that we all love. One person who hasn't come up, which I had a feeling this would happen. If you ask me who is the best horror director of all time, my answer 100% of the time is John Carpenter. Not one Carpenter film on any of our lists. And I think sometimes it's because he's too good. Like, because I start thinking, oh, well, is it The Thing or is it The Fog or is it Prince of Darkness? Like, he's so consistent in that period. But I was surprised that not one of us. But that's interesting, you know, like, because I was, you know, toying with The Thing. But his films made more of an impact a little later on me than when I was first starting. For me, the last one is that seat over there. It's called Possession. It's an in joke. It's an in joke on the show, but it's still not an in joke to me.
I love that. I love that.
That's,
so much.
Yes, there she is in all her glory. The true story is there was a director who said his pitch to Paramount. He came over from Poland. He said, "I want to make a movie where women fuck octopus." That was his actual one line pitch for this movie, and that's a god truth story from what I hear. He didn't get the money from Paramount. Believe it or not, it was. But what this movie gave to me, I won't go too deep because if you listen to the show, I've been talking about it for years. But what it is I discovered it as an adult. I discovered it in like my mid 20s when I, you know, was a little more lukewarm on some of the horror being made, and I couldn't believe somebody made something with this much level of emotion, this kind of commitment to ideas, and then something that also was scary because it was hard to understand all of it in one viewing, and the heightened emotion is like, you know, normal movies, like Jack Nicholson in The Shining is, I would consider, a big performance. That's like a 9. And Nicolas Cage in Wicker Man, the remake, is like an 11. Sam Neill and Isabella Gianni are operating on like a 24.
They're amazing.
And it's like nothing I've ever seen, and it shouldn't work. And this is the balancing act of really great art, is if somebody goes out on a high wire and somehow pulls it off, because 9 out of 10 times I would just fail and fall over and be terrible. In this case, it somehow works and creates this really powerful thing, especially if you've ever had really intense fights or breakups or marriages dissolve. This is going into that pain. The story was that the director was shooting another film that got taken away from him by the Polish government. He came home and his wife was leaving him and taking their kid for someone else. And he took all of that and just wrote this movie. And so the movie's angry and it's full of rage and it's full of, like, you know, it's a full-on attack on his wife partner who ends up being played by Johnny. And so on that level, you know, there is a slight element of misogyny to the approach, but it's also about therapy and getting it out of you so you don't carry that around with you. And that changed how I think what movies can be sometimes. And so if you haven't, it's definitely not, you know, I always tell people it's not for everyone. It's not a good date movie. That and Happiness are not a good double feature. It's just bad, you know. But it is a hell of a movie. And, you know, I love movies that keep pushing what we can have. Also, you know, I lived in New Zealand most of my life, and Sam Neill, I keep saying that. Sam Neill was kind of the only recognizable New Zealander who had broken through and was recognized in other countries. So for me to see this guy in this weird movie that I hadn't heard of, I'd seen all these other movies with him and never seen him in this movie. So I think there's something kind of personal to seeing that connection. But yeah, that's a big one for me, and I paid $50 to put my armrest right there, and I feel so good about it. Thanks, Central Cinema. So awesome. Well, look, I appreciate this from you guys. I think it's super fascinating to learn what you guys, how you do, especially things I wouldn't have predicted, like some of the contemporary choices, like Ninth Gate on Itch, and that's really like cool to get those movies back in the kind of conversation. Hopefully, you guys can like do this with people and friends, and you know, it's kind of a fun game. How are we on time? Do we have time to ask if there's any questions in general, or are we running low? Okay, so we'll just do a couple. I'll repeat them because otherwise people at home won't have a clue what we're talking about. Yeah.
All right, so we were having this debate the other day at work. When you talk about horror movies, you know, endings are always an important, sometimes crazy part of the movie. What do you think the best horror movie ending is, whether it be twist or whatever? You know, like you already talked about Night of the Living Dead. You were saying, you know, Cemetery Man, you know, a few other examples, but what do you think?
All right, so I'll just repeat it because there's somebody listening to the podcast. So he's asking what the best horror film ending, most effective horror film endings. We were obviously just talking about Night of the Living Dead. We talked about Chainsaw, which would probably be my answer, but let's open it up.
If I may say, and this is one that almost made the list for me, The Strangers. The ending of The Strangers is so scary because, A, just that one line of dialogue or that one interaction of, why are you just, because you were home. And it's so chilling. And then just to know that you're not going to see what's going to happen to them, but kids are going to see what's going to happen to them. It sends chills up my spine right now thinking about it. And that film right there is one of those films that is so scary because you never realize in a house, and I live in a big house, never realize who could be in the attic, who could be around the corner, who could be in the closet, and who's watching you. And to see that at the end where basically it's just left open to your imagination going crazy, it's almost as perfect as I'm going to say it is.
What about you, Brian? We'll walk backwards.
I like a lot of the older endings, like from older horror films, where like whatever happened, like the end of Bride of Frankenstein. That's not my answer, but the end of Bride of Frankenstein, like the castle blows up and basically like, oh, they hug and then it's over. The end.
Yeah.
You know, like I liked when that just happened in films, like, and there wasn't that like little like, oh, I'm okay, but are I? You know, and then the thing comes back.
You mean post-Carrie, basically.
Exactly. So I would say The Fly by David Cronenberg has a great ending, you know, because like he's just dead, and she cries, and then that's it. Yeah. So yeah. I think that was a great ending.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if you need any more after that, you know?
Yeah, the one thing they all tend to seem to have in common is, like, there's no denouement. There's no closure to a good horror film ending.
Yeah.
If you're giving too much closure, you're probably doing it wrong. The nightmare stops.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Besides Chainsaw,
it's kind of other films, or films that kind of in more, like, Maniac, how he's... like attacked by his own creation, and similar, like May, which I kind of view as a similar storyline. Her, like, she realizes she's finally made this thing, and that's not going to fix her. Like, this did nothing.
Yeah,
it just ends in this most depressing moment ever. Yeah. See, I love really uplifting things, guys.
Well, that, I think we all have that.
It's funny you bring that up, and I should have thought to make that connection, May and the stylist, because the ending to the stylist is very emotional. That's what gets me at the end. It's like how vulnerable she is when she has this, you know, scalp on her head. And she says, like, I have to look perfect. I have to look beautiful. You know, it's very sad. Very sad.
Yeah, the only, I mean, I think The Wicker Man's one of the best, but it's hard to talk about without being spoiled. But the most shocking, the only thing as an adult viewer that has actually scared me, like, I think I was like 22, and I was sitting in this theater, and my jaw was, I had to like pick it off the ground and like re-put myself together, was the ending of Don't Look Now. I did not see that fucking coming, and I was just like, and I was so horrified. And then you realize the whole movie's just about that. It's about somebody who does not see what is right in front of them, and that's going to be what takes them down. But that thing, so I'm not going to ruin it for anyone because it's an amazing movie, but the ending of that movie fucked me up big time. But it does open, I think part of his question, just quickly, on is, do you guys, what do you guys think about twist endings to horror? Because we're talking about kind of like final shock moments, and then the horror ends, but then you've got movies like Sixth Sense that are completely built on a twist. I find that to be a little less rewatchable, but once you know the story. But any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm less a fan of twisty things because, like you said, you're just kind of then lied to for a whole movie just for this one moment. I mean, and if that moment doesn't work, your whole movie is. But then there's the few that are really successful with it.
Yeah.
And this is barely, you know, debated if it's horror, but like Seven, I don't know if you'd call that a twist, but that's the most shocking and successful, I feel like, ending of a film ever.
Nothing is coming to mind at the moment, so I'm going to pass,
I think
to you. Maybe I'll come back to it.
I like the idea, Seven. The reason why I like the twist endings in certain cases is because there's a very interesting fan theory that Morgan Freeman's character was the mind, was the actual antagonist the entire time. And it's brought up like that because of that twist ending when they're in the field and what's in the box, that kind of moment. So it opens up more conversation about the film, especially when it's made by a master like Fincher. You know, you know it's going to be good. The payoff, you know, is going to be something quality. You know, you can't say that about most films.
Now that you say that, it's kind of hinted that it's about him, because it opens with him getting ready for his day, and you meet Brad later. So
yeah, exactly.
That's
right.
That's probably a clue. Well,
and throwback to a week ago's Shockwaves. I have to be a good foot soldier. Andrew
good
Kevin
man.
Walker, the screenwriter, was on, and I wasn't there, but I never listened to our show because I'm on it. But I listened to that, and it's one of the best interviews I've heard with a screenwriter, especially because he talks about how basically that box thing was not going to happen in this film because he was going to be taken off, and they had somebody else had done the rewrite, and that was not part of the ending. And David Fincher was like, where's that boxing? Because that's the only reason I want to make this movie.
Wow.
And so they got to go back to his draft, and he stayed on the project, changed his life. It's a really interesting interview if you're interested in screenwriting, and, you know, super dark. There's someone very keen arm there. Yeah.
First, I'd like to say there's two times you see possession. One, before you have a horrible breakup, you're like, what is this movie? And second,
I couldn't
well
agree
said,
more
Stephen.
With you.
Well said, Stephen.
He just said there's two, for the people at home, there's two times to watch Possession. One, before you have a horrible breakup, so you can kind of brace yourself and get ready, and then after you've already had it, and it's like everything's easy cake after that. So.
And what are your favorite end lines from a horror film?
Oh, favorite last lines. Damn, that's always hard. I'm terrible at remembering character names and lines. Do you have any favorite lines in general from movie? If it's not last, jumping off what he... Obviously, Army of Darkness is so loaded with lines.
Yeah, that one has... Hail to the King, baby. That's the last line of the movie,
Mine's definitely Get a Job in a Sideshow. I think that's just so funny. Reanimator is such a funny movie. But.
I was just talking about this line the other day. Lillard's line at the end when he asks Neve Campbell, he's like, did you really call the cops?
Yeah.
He's like crying, my mom's going to be so mad at me. Yeah, that's good. So fucking funny.
I love gazebo. You like that word? And the Dead Zone. It's so good because it's so creepy the way it's just set up. And I mean that whole scene from the Dead Zone is amazing.
Oh, I do have one, and it would have been my sixth movie if this was a sixth movie handshake. Another huge influence on me is Hellraiser and Jesus Wept.
Yes,
just astounding way to put a line and then have a guy's entire face explode. So it's good stuff. All right, we might have one more until William starts going like crazy at me, and we'll go there, and then we'll come to the front.
If you were doing a movie night on Halloween with a bunch of people who don't like horror movies,
oh shit!
What horror movie would you show to try?
Get new friends.
Yeah,
that's a friend fail.
Trying to introduce them to.
They're not worthy. Okay, so what would like a couple movies that you would want to introduce someone on Halloween who's not already into horror?
Well, I probably would lose a lot of friends because I just want to show them Freaks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Just rather show them Freaks and just ruin
them
their day.
Really upset them.
Yeah, I just want to really upset them. Yeah, movie. And just show them Freaks. Yeah, fuck them. Yeah. More pizza for me.
I would say Final Destination. Final Destination is such a great hybrid. It's a thriller, and that's another one where I walked out of the theater. I had the best time watching it, so I would say Final Destination.
I'm just going to throw out The Descent, more recent. That's, I think, one of the scariest, best horror films of the last 20, 30 years.
Yeah, I love The Descent, too. I don't even know what that looks like. I mean, it's like, because we're all our friends, it's like, I guess I still think Poltergeist is still one of the best horror films, but then if they don't like horror films, then they're going to hate that, too, because they're going to get the shit scared out of them. So I that's a hard one, man. I got no answer for you, and it's rare that I can't have words. So I'm pleading the fifth. Run right here.
Good question. That is, probably your favorite one-and-done horror films by a director did just one horror movie. That's it. And for me, it's always was Bill Paxton with Frailty, because that movie messed me up.
That's so good.
Yeah, that is a good one.
So one and done. So it doesn't mean it's not like Charles Laughton, who did just Night of the Hunter and made no more movies. They could have made other movies, but they made one horror movie, which is what a lot of directors talk about wanting to do. They're like, they want to make that one foray into horror and nail it and get out like what Kubrick did. Any spring to mind?
This is tough because I feel like it might be a film. I don't know if it was only made by...
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
I don't know.
Go for it.
No one will ever hear this. Good. What's the matter?
Know. You don't know?
Good.
I need to think.
Okay, well, the one that comes to mind is It Follows, because I don't know if that guy is ever going to make another horror movie, and I feel like he did it.
I don't think he'll direct one. He's writing one for somebody to direct, but I agree with you. I think he's going to probably push in other directions. I agree. That's a good choice.
Yeah, but I agree. Like, Frailty is an awesome choice, you know, because, imagine if Bill Paxton got to do more. Did he direct anything, like even television? Yeah. Was it just the one?
He directed Big Love, for sure.
Did he do?
Because he was on that.
Drama pieces.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to say, I'm not going to butcher his name, but the mind behind Train to Busan. Because him coming as an animator, I don't know if he's ever going to do anything like that again, and if he wants to do anything like that again. And when we're talking about horror, we're talking about live-action feature, you know. And so I would say Train to Busan. That's the first thing that comes up. But Frailty is a great pick. You can't go wrong with Frailty.
I mean, obviously, this looks like the kind of room that's a lot of big Howard the Duck fans here, but especially at the back, I see you guys going smiling. But the people who made that, they also wrote American Graffiti. They made one of my favorite movies of all time, Messiah of Evil, and they kind of are in denial about it, and they still don't put a lot of love behind it. They kind of don't like talking about it, but if you watch the Blu-ray of that film is up there with Carnival of Souls, of these just like perfect little nightmares put on film. It Follows, I feel like, has a little bit of that vibe, but it's just funny because they just had no interest in talking about it particularly, and the idea that they went on to kind of write. I think maybe they were co-writers on one of the Indiana Jones films, I believe so. So like, they just were making big stuff, but they started, and it's often where people start, you know. But that would probably be one.
Is The Exorcist the only horror film?
He made
The Guardian. Okay.
So yeah, I was thinking of that too. Yeah.
What about we got like Bigelow's Near Dark? Did she do another horror film?
Nope. Mm-hmm. No, and that's a great choice.
Or like Mary Harron's American Psycho.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Near Dark's a
maybe
really
they don't
good.
Give females a second chance. What's up with that?
No, she. I think she went on to big things in her mind, but
you know what? I'm just without looking. Scott Glosserman for Behind the Mask: The Rise of Leslie Vernon. Yeah. That is one right there, and he never the sequel never got off the ground, and he pushed and pushed and pushed. It never happened. I'm kind of glad it never happened because that is really a classic film, yeah. A classic slasher that redefines quite a lot. So it's in the same elk as Scream.
Yeah, and they tried.
Yeah, they did.
One last thing to wrap up. So, right at the front.
Oh,
right,
of course.
We're living in her house, so we have to go.
Whether it be a horror film or not, what was a movie that gave you nightmares?
Oh. So what is a movie that gave, whether it's horror or not, what movie gave you nightmares?
I have two. One is The Hand That Rocks the Cradle.
Oh.
Rebecca De Mornay. She is there a scarier female antagonist, and she's justified in some of the things she's doing. The other one is Aliens.
What?
Aliens scared the hell out of me the first time I saw it because it's an action film, so being young, you're kind of lured in as it's guns and stuff, but it's so much scarier than just an action film. And for me, I was terrified for weeks from it.
I'll go with Fire in the Sky because I hate alien abductions.
Yeah. Yeah.
I couldn't sleep on my back. I don't sleep on my back anymore because I don't want a rubber sheet coming down on me.
No problem.
Bunch of aliens trying to shove jelly down my throat. No thanks.
Just let it happen, Brian.
I'm good.
No. Just let it happen.
just accept it. There you go. Yeah.
I thought I saw a better one. Beetlejuice. I remember a babysitter playing it for me when I don't even know, like 3 years old. And I don't think I could really follow the narrative. It was just like the image, you know, it is terrifying. I had nightmares about Beetlejuice like crazy. I didn't watch it again until I was an adult.
Yeah. It's all when you see something. That's the whole thing.
That there's moments in Beetlejuice that I remember as a kid being terrified. And I think for some reason I watched the cartoon before I saw the movie.
Oh,
so I was like, oh, sandworms. And they were like, not look the way they looked in the cartoon and stuff. And then like when Gina Davis pulls her face off, I watch it now. And I'm like, ah, silly. But I was scared of that when I was a kid. And then when Beetlejuice becomes the snake, because stop motion was still a scary thing to me, and just like a large margin, Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
For me, it was everyone. Probably, if you listen, you know it's Fluffy from The Crate. Gave me nightmares for about 15 years, but like not all the time, but like really the same kind of recurring nightmare. And I didn't know what movie it was from for like about 10, maybe like 8 years after I saw that at 5, somebody made me watch it, Creepshow, and then I had these nightmares and I didn't know what they were from until I was much older when I finally watched the whole Creepshow and realized, oh, it was this one scene and this one creature. And it's amazing what that can do to you. Like, you know, I slept with the bed sheets up to here, and but it was this, and now I watch him and he's so adorable and cute and fun. You know, it's just such a great creature that it's really surprising. And I will say, if you listen to this week's episode, I just finished Haunting of Hill House, and it's the first time since I've been an adult that I had nightmares after watching something about episode 6 or something. I just went to bed and it's almost like the slow burn, and the way it's not really trying to scare you as much as just place doubt and kind of dread there, and it kind of got into my dreams and started having nightmares, and I was like, shit, Mike Flanagan is working away on something really special with that series.
Amazing.
I'll tell you, I didn't give me nightmares, but I woke up and I was like, I can't go back to sleep after I saw Hereditary.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, I woke up at 4 in the morning. I was like, I'm not going back to bed, and I'm not going to look up above me because Toni Collette's going to be there. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, that terrified me. That movie terrified me.
Yeah, no, and we're lucky every year. Every year somebody says horror is dead, and every year horror is doing better than the year before, and we get better movies. Like this year, there's already like 10 great movies I can think of off the top of my head, and there's still like a couple months to go. So I want to thank you guys for coming out and supporting this. This is super awesome. On a personal note, the people who come up to me and say, hey, I've been listening since Killer POV, like that gives us so much fuel to keep doing this. It really does. I know that the other hosts feel the same way. We do this just out of like a love of wanting to do this, and it's sometimes hard with people's schedules, and it's like 6 years in now basically, and every time one person goes, hey, I love that, I listen every week, that gets you another year of the show basically. That's how I view it, you know, that's what keeps the cycle going. I want to thank the three of you for doing this and
thank you
having such a fun
thank
weekend
you.
Hanging out with you guys and getting awesome. To know you. So still some really cool stuff left to come tonight, so yeah, thank you very much, and see you next time.
Thank you.
I have a little promo for everybody. So because you all came out to see us talk and just see how I'm put to shame compared to all the other people who
anyway.
Know horror, I wanted to give a promo. We have BFF Girls is available on pre-order on Vimeo On Demand, and there is a promo code that you can use where you get 50% off the purchase, and it's today only, and it's BFF Knox, and it's limited to 25. And then because you all have been asking about Gwilliam is also available on Vimeo On Demand, and if you type in Gob Knox as the promo code you get 50% off purchasing Gwilliam today only. Woo!
Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. You're going to need a bigger closet with Fright Rags' biggest sale of the year. Huge savings on tons of tees, pins, socks, and more now through Wednesday, November 28th. Hurry, sales are while supplies last and shirts are literally flying off the shelves. Save an extra 10% with coupon code SHOCK10. 10% off through December 31st. Severin Films Black Glove Friday Sale, November 23rd to 25th, featuring the two-disc Blu-ray Special Edition, premiere of Sergio Martino's classic giallo, All the Colors of the Dark, starring Edvig Fennec with soundtrack CD. Also available in a strictly limited slipcase with the three-disc All the Colors of Giallo, new feature-length documentary, Hours of Giallo, and creamy trailers, and a new compilation CD of giallo themes, selected by Rendezvous from the archives of Beat Records in Rome. Also premiering limited slip for the Severin Black Friday sale, Ivan Nagy's Skinner, starring Ted Raimi and Tracy Lords. Scanned in 4K from the original negative, uncut, uncensored, and packed with extras for the first time on disc anywhere. And finally, get real strange with the first in the Severin Films Something Weird video line of Blu-rays, two Mondo double features, Mondo Bizarro and Mondo Freudo, and Eco and The Forbidden. The Severin Films Black Friday sale with 50% discount on most catalog titles and new merchandise and exclusive on All the Colors of the Dark, All the Colors of Giallo, Skinner, Mondo Bizarro, Mondo Freudo, Eco, and The Forbidden. Do not miss the Severin Films Black Friday sale at www.severin-films.com. Tonight's Shockwaves is brought to you by Shudder. AMC Network Shudder is a premium streaming video service serving fans of all degrees with the best selection of horror and thrillers. Shudder's irrepressible and thriving community revels in all things provocative, evocative, and dangerous. From bantering with Shudder on social media and contributing fantastic and irreverent reviews to relishing in member-only perks such as exclusive releases and VIP movie screenings, Shudder believes there is safety in numbers. You can stream great thrillers, horror, and suspense for $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year. Shudder has the largest, fastest-growing human-curated selection of thrilling and dangerous entertainment, and they've been dubbed the Netflix for horror. And I'd say right now there are some excellent originals on there. Terrified has been Shockwaves approved. The Witch in the Window and the series Dead Wax are all fantastic. To try Shudder free for 30 days, go to shudder.com/podcast, and that's Shudder, S-H-U-D-D-E-R. And use the promo code WAVES.